I'm reading from an unfinished essay, 50 Years of the Deep State, by Mark Gorton. It was published on the internet in spring of 2014, and I used it to produce a couple of episodes of my radio show Unwelcome Guests, and I thought it justified this standalone recording as an audiobook. I begin with the covering note with which he sent it to his employees.
50 Years of the Deep State. Dear friends and loved ones, today, November the 22nd, 2013, is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. About 6 years ago, quite by accident, I took a passing interest in the assassination of JFK. My research into the assassination of JFK took me on a path into the dark underbelly of the CIA, and from there I traced a web of criminality that ran through the huge sections of federal government, the political power structure, and the business interests that control our country. As I researched more, I learnt that the criminal network behind JFK's assassination did not retire after his killing. Instead, the need to cover up past crimes has motivated them to commit more crimes in a never-ending cycle that continues to this present day. I have tracked this criminal network through time, and I've learnt that this cabal has been the most significant political force in the United States for the last 50 years. Yet most people don't have any idea that it exists. My research project has grown to be a major interest in my life. I have a total of 180 books on the topics of the JFK assassination and the ensuing actions of the criminal cabal that seized control of our government. 70 of these books I have read cover to cover, and the rest I have either read a particular section or skimmed. I have dozens and dozens of books on my to-read list, as I am continually researching different strands of government criminality. In addition to reading books, I have spent countless hours doing research on the internet. I now have a profound understanding of the dark forces that control how politics in our country really work. 50 years ago, a network of criminals took control of our government, and they have not let go until the present day. I cannot passively accept living in a country where democracy has been overthrown. Yet I cannot help but feel helpless against the powerful forces that have been systematically killing their opposition for decades. In my desire to heal our democracy, I have searched for answers as to how the powerless can confront the powerful. When confronted with evil that they could not prevent, Quakers have a tradition of bearing witness so that this evil does not pass unnoted. On this 50th anniversary of the coup d'etat known as the JFK assassination, this document is my attempt to bear witness to the crimes of the last 50 years in my hope that, in my own small way, my voice can help repair our country. As I've studied the hidden history of the United States for the last 50 years, I have not only learned of criminal networks embedded within our government, I have also learned the stories of many, many honest Americans who have fought to save our country. These unsung heroes of democracy have fought courageously to save the soul of our country. These Americans have risked their careers and their lives so that our dreams of freedom and democracy would not die. This document is dedicated to the hundreds and hundreds of Americans who have paid with their lives the ultimate price of confronting the cabal embedded within our government. The Coup of 63. Among serious researchers of JFK's assassination, a remarkable unanimity of opinion has been achieved. Thanks to the tens of thousands of man-years of effort that have gone into studying the JFK assassination, the depth and breadth of the plot can be known. The plot was a giant domestic conspiracy that involved elements of the entire U.S. power structure. The assassination of JFK was part of a full-scale coup d'état, the violent takeover of our government by a group of criminals. I have not the slightest doubt in my mind that JFK's assassination was the work of a network of criminals embedded within the political system and power structure of the United States. Key among the players in the coup of 63 were LBJ, Alan Dulles and the CIA, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, right-wing Texas oil executives including Clint Murchison Sr., H.L. Hunt and D.H. Byrd, the East Coast business establishment centered around Rockefeller interests and the Council on Foreign Relations, Curtis LeMay, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, other right-wing leaders from the military and elements of the military intelligence, and the Bush family, both Prescott and George H.W. Bush. In 1961, President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned against, quote,
"the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex."
Eisenhower continued,
"the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together."
Perhaps Eisenhower may more accurately have described this threat as the military intelligence complex, as the CIA had been operating free from proper oversight since its founding in 1947. Acting under the cover of protecting the world from communism, powerful interests found American imperialism to be enormously profitable, and the secrecy within the CIA provided the perfect environment for criminal elements to prosper. JFK was aware of these forces, and he chose to fight against them. JFK and his brother RFK took on a host of entrenched, corrupt interests. The CIA, big business, the mafia, and the corrupt Texas interests surrounding LBJ. A huge swath of the American power structure was at risk of being displaced and even ending up in jail by the crusades of the Kennedy brothers. LBJ was incredibly corrupt. He even had his own personal hitman, Mac Wallace, who'd been killing people for a decade to keep LBJ's crimes from being exposed. With RFK as Attorney General, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI could no longer protect the mob. Top mafia chieftains, including Carlos Morcellos and Salvatore Trafficante, risked trading their sweet mafia kingpin lifestyle for a life behind bars, due to RFK's crusade against the mafia. The CIA was out of control, and JFK had vowed to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces. Right-wing Cold Warrior generals in charge of the U.S. military were just itching for a possibly nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and JFK's calls for peace were viewed as being treason among the right-wing set. Leaders of giant companies, used to having a compliant government do their bidding, found that JFK actually looked out for the interests of the little guy. Add on to this the Kennedys' support for the civil rights movement gaining strength in the South, and a huge array of powerful, entrenched, entitled interests was in position to be mobilized to resist change. But potential does not equal action, and it took the political genius of Lyndon Baines Johnson to activate these forces to bring about a coup d'état. The Kennedys and Johnson were involved in a sub rosa war from the beginning on their administration. Bobby Kennedy was telling the Washington press corps that it was open season on LBJ, and Bobby was having the Justice Department feed information on LBJ's corruption to a number of different Senate investigations, any one of which could have ended LBJ's career
and started his slide towards prison. But LBJ may not have needed the impetus of fear for his career and freedom to motivate him to kill JFK. As majority leader of the Senate, LBJ was arguably the second most powerful man in Washington. Many of his colleagues were surprised when LBJ accepted the nomination for vice president, an office which his fellow Texan and former Vice President John Garner described as being, quote, not worth a bucket of warm piss, unquote. Claire Booth Luce asked LBJ why he agreed to be vice president, and LBJ told her that he'd done research and 6 out of 33 presidents had managed to achieve office without being elected. And he told her,
I'm a gambling man.
But a study of LBJ's history shows that he was anything but a gambling man. In fact, LBJ was a man who left nothing to chance. Most likely, LBJ planned to kill JFK from the moment he considered becoming vice president. Although John F. Kennedy was finally killed in Dallas on November 22, 1963, the plot to kill him was active for at least a couple of years. The first attempt to kill JFK, of which I'm aware, was to take place in Mexico City at the end of June 1962, but was aborted due to last-minute escape problems. From that time on, JFK was a hunted man. Other attempts were planned for Los Angeles, Grand Rapids, Chicago, Tampa, Miami, and Houston. The planned assassination attempt on JFK in Miami on June 18, 1963, was foiled when people loyal to JFK leaked word of the plot and the planned motorcade was cancelled in favor of helicopter transport. By the time November 22 rolled around, LBJ was getting increasingly desperate. The December 6, 1963 issue of Life magazine, due to be printed and mailed on November 29, 1963, was set to run an expose of Lyndon Johnson's corruption that could have ended his career. The earlier plots to kill JFK that were designed with more distance between the coup plotters and the trigger man had failed, and now Johnson risked more active involvement by having his people directly orchestrate both the motorcade planning and the take-apart of the President's Secret Service protection. By the time JFK's motorcade rolled through Dallas, little had been left to chance. As Chauncey Holt said, quote,
there were more mercenaries in Dealey Plaza that day than at a Soldier of Fortune convention, unquote.
The success of the coup depended not only upon the ability of the shooters to escape undetected, but upon the certitude that the cabal behind the assassination could control the investigation and the story reported in the media. JFK had no idea how little chance he had of making it through Dealey Plaza alive. The Dallas police protection of the motorcade route ended right at the start of Dealey Plaza. In fact, one of the shooters was probably a Dallas police officer. The Secret Service protection surrounding JFK was removed. In my estimate, 6 shooters awaited from a variety of vantage points. The Secret Service agent driving JFK's car brought the car to a complete stop, and a barrage of shots from all directions converged on JFK. After confirming that JFK had been killed, JFK's driver put the car in motion and continued driving. The coup of 63 did not end with the killing of JFK. The shooting part of the assassination was relatively small compared to the cover-up. The planning for the cover-up was built into the fabric of the plot. Lee Harvey Oswald was set up as the patsy. Oswald did not fire a shot in Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald was a CIA contract agent who'd been sent into Russia as a fake defector. He then returned to the U.S. and used his time in Russia as an entry into the left-wing pro-Castro movement. Lee Harvey Oswald is a fairly minor character in the coup of 63, but through him a multi-layered counterintelligence plot can be seen. The coup of 63 had within it many, many contingency strategies built. The coup went almost according to plan. The only thing that went wrong on November 22, 1963, was that the Dallas police failed to kill Lee Harvey Oswald,
so Jack Ruby was tasked with the ensuing killing of Oswald. However, the coup plotters had no way of knowing that things would go so smoothly, so they embedded within Oswald a variety of cover stories which could have been deployed under different scenarios. Oswald could have been made to look like a racist, a Cuban, a Russian, or even to have mob ties. However, since the coup went so close to plan, he was declared to be a lone nut and dismissed as such. The contingencies beyond how to blame Oswald were much more serious. If it were superficially obvious that JFK's killing was the result of a conspiracy, Castro was to be blamed, and an invasion of Cuba was to quickly follow. Many anti-Castro Cubans who participated in the coup were deeply disappointed that the invasion of Cuba never materialized. My studies of the coup of 63 have led me to believe that even graver fallback strategies were embedded in the plot. If JFK's killing was obviously perceived as being part of a large conspiracy, and the US public was not buying the Castro did it angle, the coup plotters were truly in dire straits. These desperate men who ran the military, the FBI, some of the largest companies in the world, and the US government, faced the prospect of being hung for treason. I believe that the darkest scenarios envisioned by the coup plotters involved declaring martial law and blaming the Russians and taking the country to, and possibly over, the brink of nuclear war with Russia. Interestingly, the Russian intelligence was aware of the plans to kill Kennedy, and they were aware that through Lee Harvey Oswald they were to be set up to take the blame. So, in September of 1963, the KGB attempted to kill Lee Harvey Oswald to prevent themselves from being sucked into a false war. But the assassination capabilities of the Russians within the United States were fairly limited, and the KGB were unable to kill Oswald. The cover-up. Elaborate plans for the cover-up of JFK's assassination went into action after his killing. JFK's body was secretly rushed to Washington, D.C., aboard Air Force Two, while an empty casket sat in the hold of Air Force One, and LBJ countermanded Secret Service advice and stalled takeoff by demanding to be sworn in on the tarmac in Dallas. JFK's body was then worked on in pre-autopsy surgery to reconstruct his skull and hide the nature of his wounds. The autopsy itself was conducted at Bethesda Naval Hospital outside of Washington, D.C., under control of the top military brass. The clearest evidence of the military involvement in the coup can be seen in the handling of the autopsy. The lead agency in the cover-up was the FBI. The FBI was pushing the Oswald did it, case closed, party line within 2 hours of JFK's death. The entire FBI investigation was aimed at convicting Oswald and ignoring or destroying any evidence that pointed in another direction. Witness intimidation was frequently employed for anyone who had testimony that contradicted what the FBI wanted to hear. When, despite the most earnest pronouncements of J. Edgar Hoover, the public still was skeptical of the official version of who killed JFK, LBJ put together the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission was made up of some of the most eminent men in the country, including Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren. The Warren Commission was designed to approve the already firm FBI conclusions, and, with a bit of extra process, it did exactly that. JFK's bitter enemy and coup leader, Alan Dulles, was the most active member of the Warren Commission. Key other commission members active in the cover-up were Council of Foreign Relations Chairman John McCloy, Gerald Ford, and Earl Warren himself. Commission member Senator Richard Russell was a man of great integrity, and despite his being LBJ's mentor in the Senate, he insisted on issuing a dissenting report. However, Senator Russell's report was suppressed and only surfaced decades later in his private papers. The Warren Commission had no investigative resources of its own, and it replied completely upon FBI investigators. The Warren Commission did interview witnesses, but it cherry-picked the witnesses to obtain testimony that favored its preordained conclusions. Warren commissioned staff attorneys, steered witnesses away from relevant insights, and also falsified testimony in order to cover up inconvenient facts that happened to poke through. The threat of nuclear war was embedded in the fabric of the plot, which was used to cow business, media, and government leaders, who under other circumstances would not have gone along with a cover-up of the assassination, into tacitly working with the coup plotters. The media complicity in the coup of 63 can be traced in part to the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. Elite members of the CFR, such as Alan Dulles, Nelson Rockefeller, George Herbert Walker Bush, and McGeorge Bundy, were sponsors of the JFK assassination. CFR members Alan Dulles, John McCloy, and Gerald Ford played dominant roles in the Warren Commission cover-up of the coup d'etat. A remarkable fraction of the publishers, editors, and senior reporters of the most important media outlets in the country were also members of the Council on Foreign Relations, including Henry Luce, publisher of Time Life, Claire Booth Luce, Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, William Paley, owner of CBS, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, and Bob Schiffer, all CBS, Peter Jennings, ABC, James Reston, Anthony Lewis, and Harrison Salisbury, all New York Times, Jack Valenti, Daniel Shaw, and in later days Rupert Murdoch, Michael Eisner, Bill Clinton, George Stephanopoulos, and Brian Williams. The list goes on and on. Any questioning of the Warren Commission involved impugning the honor of their CFR colleagues who ran the Warren Commission, and any serious investigation of the JFK assassination would have risked accusing their fraternity brothers of treason. The secrets of JFK's assassination were so close to home that ignorance and denial were safer than the truth. Now, some reporters weren't part of this club and doggedly tried to find the truth. Reporters who could not be controlled were murdered by the criminals running the government. Over the years, certainly 50, and more likely more than 100 people have been killed to preserve the secrets of the coup of 63. Many witnesses, reporters, people who knew too much, plot members at risk of being exposed, overzealous law enforcement officials have all been killed. Some of these deaths were clearly violent. Many were made to look like something else. Anyone who was a threat to the exposure of the cabal that took over the government had to be neutralized. In order to do this, the cabal behind the coup of 63 built a mechanism of domestic death squads, and also the mechanism to cover up these crimes. The quickening of the cabal. The criminals who took over the government had an incredible fear of being exposed. If exposed, they would be hung for treason. Fear of exposure bound the network behind the coup of 63 into an incredibly powerful political force which has dominated the American federal political system for the last 50 years. The assassination continues to be an important event that every American should take the time to understand, because the powerful forces that seized control of our government 50 years ago have not let go. As I studied the coup of 63, I began to perceive this cabal behind JFK's assassination, and, as I've studied their actions, I've understood their desperate need to control the American political system. If the cabal were ever to lose control of the American political system, they risk exposure for a litany of crimes which continue to this present day. 6 years ago, I started studying the JFK assassination out of curiosity. But as I came to understand the coup of 63, and I was able to perceive the cabal behind the coup as an incredible political force, I began to study a series of events. Many of these events were also conspiracies, dismissed as crazy by the mainstream media, and I saw that these conspiracies were the work of the same network of people. And what I've been doing for the last several years has been tracking the work of this evolving cabal through time. In order to escape justice for their heinous crimes, the cabal needed to build a number of capabilities for themselves. The cabal needed to be able to kill with impunity anyone who threatened to expose them. They needed to be able to control the press. They needed to control the presidency, federal law enforcement agencies, and the intelligence community. Operating under the secret cover of national security, from within the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the ONI, military intelligence, etc., the cabal has been able to systematically destroy threats to itself. With control of the FBI, Justice Department, DEA, ATF, etc., the cabal has been able to ensure that no serious investigation into its crimes would take place, and massive, highly successful programs to control the press, like the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, have ensured that the mainstream media would systematically ignore and dismiss all claims of high-level government corruption. With the control of law enforcement, intelligence agencies, and the press, the cabal built itself the perfect machine for committing crimes and getting away with them. And with these capabilities, the cabal has run amok for the last 50 years. The assassination of RFK. The RFK assassination gives a good idea of the capability of this system. Bobby Kennedy knew that his brother had been killed by a conspiracy. He had a vague sense of the outlines of this conspiracy, but trapped within the Johnson administration, he lacked the power to determine the truth for sure. Bobby's plan was to wait until he could attain the presidency, and then, with the full power of the presidency, he would relentlessly hunt down his brother's killers and avenge JFK's death. The cabal could not allow RFK to become president, and from the moment they seized power, they worked relentlessly to build the mechanism to let them kill Bobby Kennedy and cover up the truth behind his killing. The cabal acquired a variety of mechanisms to kill their enemies. One such mechanism was to use special forces operatives from the U.S. military who'd been trained to obey orders unquestioningly, and once told that someone was an enemy of the state, they would ignorantly and dutifully dispatch this person. Since World War II, the Mafia and the CIA had developed a close, mutually supportive relationship. In many cases, mob hitmen could be deployed on behalf of their intelligence and political masters. Within the CIA and other intelligence organizations were cold-blooded hitmen who knew well that they were part of a criminal network embedded within the government. In addition, many alliances existed between international intelligence agencies. Assassination capabilities were often traded between these agencies. In cases of a high-profile killing where a patsy was needed, brainwashed killers from the CIA's MK-Ultra program could be deployed. Since the early 1950s, the CIA's MK-Ultra program had been using drugs, hypnosis, and a combination of other techniques to produce robot assassins. Not long after Bobby Kennedy declared his candidacy for president, an assassination team stalked and killed Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. This assassination team was composed of the primary shooter, Thane Eugene Caesar, dressed as a security guard, MK Ultra subject Sirhan Sirhan, who discharged his gun wildly, and a network of handlers and other helpers. In case that lone nut cover of Sirhan Sirhan didn't hold, the RFK killing was designed to be blamed on first the Palestinians, and then a combination of the Russians and Aristotle Onassis. Onassis hated Bobby Kennedy and wanted him out of the way, so he could marry Jackie Kennedy. Onassis was brought into the plot by intelligence operatives, and he did fund some of the assassination plot. Although Onassis was involved in the plot to kill RFK, the hierarchy behind the assassination was headed by LBJ. Just as with the killing of JFK, the cover-up of RFK's assassination was a larger operation than the killing itself. During the early 1960s, the CIA engaged in joint training exercises with local police departments across the country. Nominally, the training was intended to improve federal-local cooperation on intelligence matters. In reality, these exercises provided a mechanism for the CIA to control local police investigations across the country.
Manuel Pena, the LAPD officer with control of the RFK assassination, had previously worked doing special ops for the CIA. He'd worked closely with David Morales, a CIA hitman who had a significant operational role in the JFK assassination. Beyond developing assassination and cover-up capabilities, the 5 years between the coup of 63 and RFK's killing had allowed the cabal to consolidate their control of the press. CIA agents were inserted as reporters and editors at all of the major media outlets in the country. The meme that conspiracy theorists were kooks was developed within the CIA and deployed with great effectiveness. During the 1960s, the overwhelming mass of news information reaching the eyes and ears of Americans came from 15 organizations: NBC, ABC, CBS, AP, UPI, Time Life, McGraw-Hill, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, New York Times, Washington Post, Metro Media, Westinghouse, Capital Cities, the North American Newspaper Alliance, and the Saturday Evening Post. The cabal was successful in co-opting the top management at each of these organizations and enlisting them into active involvement in the cover-up of the coup of 63. During the period 1964-68, internal research teams in several of these organizations reached the conclusion that the Kennedy assassination had been the result of a conspiracy. In each and every case, management at the highest editorial and corporate level took actions to overrule, suppress, lock up, edit, or otherwise alter these internal findings to back up the conclusions of the Warren Commission. Project Mockingbird was a CIA program to control the U.S. press. The exact size of Project Mockingbird remains classified, but bits of information have slipped out over time that allow for budgetary estimates to be computed. In 1978, the CIA propaganda budget was estimated to be $265 million and involved 2,000 personnel, making it larger than the combined budgets of Reuters, the Associated Press, and United Press International. In 1977, Carl Bernstein reported that the CIA had over 400 reporters and editors at major U.S. media outlets on its payroll. Descendants of this program continue up until the present day. The cabal behind the coup of 63's ongoing battle to control the presidency. Controlling the presidency was a key for the cabal members behind the coup of 63. With Bobby Kennedy out of the way, the cabal worked to steer the 1968 election to Richard Nixon by using agents provocateurs to instigate riots in Chicago at the 1968 Democratic Convention. In addition, the anti-war reform political coalition that was beginning to coalesce around Martin Luther King was neutralized by the state-sponsored killing of MLK. Dr. King's assassination was organized by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, military intelligence, and elements of the Memphis Police Department. New Orleans mafia kingpin Carlos Marcello, who played a meaningful role in JFK's assassination, played a significant role in Martin Luther King's killing. In the case of Dr. King's assassination, James Earl Ray was the patsy who was set up to take the blame, although he had no involvement in the shooting. The actual assassination was handled by elements of the Memphis police, with help from the local mafia at the request of Carlos Marcello. A backup team of army snipers, Operation Detachment Alpha 184 team, under the direction of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, were also present in Memphis the day of the assassination as a backup in case the Mafia and Memphis Police Department team did not get the job done. Although the military snipers had MLK in their sights, they were not required to fire. Nixon's relationship with the cabal. Nixon was not a cabal member, but he was controllable. Nixon's political career had been sponsored by cabal members Prescott Bush and the Dulles brothers, and their Eastern business establishment allies. During his first term, Nixon grappled with the CIA, but did nothing serious to rein in its excesses. As the cabal behind the coup of 63 positioned itself for the 1972 election,
Nixon still seemed to be the best option for them. Nixon had a reputation for using dirty tricks, and Nixon was certainly no angel, but much of the dirty criminal political tricks done on Nixon's behalf were the work of a network of people loyal not to Nixon, but the cabal. The 1968-72 period saw the emergence of a young Karl Rove under the tutelage of CIA asset Robert Bennett and political slime master Donald Segretti. Segretti, Rove and Company conducted a series of disinformation campaigns against strong Democratic candidates Edmund Muskie, Edward Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, and Henry Jackson, ensuring that Nixon would face off against the fairly weak George McGovern. The promised entrance into the 1972 presidential race of George Wallace as a third-party candidate threatened to drain votes from Nixon and throw the election to the Democrats. To neutralize Wallace, the cabal decided to have him killed. A network of people, including Rove's mentor, Donald Segretti, coordinated the shooting of Wallace, which didn't kill him but left Wallace paralyzed and knocked him out of the race, ensuring Nixon's election. Once Nixon was elected to his second term as president, he achieved a degree of independence that made him a danger to the cabal. Deep down, Nixon was never as corrupt as core cabal members, and towards the end of his first term, he began making plans to purge the entire senior leadership of the CIA. Unfortunately, Nixon didn't realize that the CIA had the White House bugged and his senior staff filled with spies, so the cabal leadership was well aware of Nixon's plans. Nixon had a reputation for being paranoid, yet he was not paranoid enough. His enemies had him surrounded to a degree which he did not understand. Although cabal members put Nixon on his path to power, they never trusted Nixon, and as early as 1966, before Nixon was even an official candidate for president, the cabal worked to booby-trap Nixon's administration. And in 1973, after Nixon had stopped being a compliant servant of the cabal, they set off the booby trap in the form of the Watergate coup, and they pulled Nixon down from power just as they had put him up. The traditional story of Watergate is one where Nixon does a bunch of bad things, gets caught, tries to cover it up, and is forced to resign. However, in reality, Watergate was a plot by the cabal behind the coup of 63, and corrupt elements within the CIA and military intelligence to depose Nixon. By 1973, the original leaders of the cabal were dying off. Allen Dulles died in 1969, J. Edgar Hoover in 1972, and LBJ in 1973. The death of their leaders created a power vacuum at the top of the cabal. And as the cabal was fighting off threats from the outside world, an internal battle was taking place for control of the cabal and ultimately the control of power in America. Three factions fought for power. A network of old boys from the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the World War II precursor to the CIA, a group within the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, and a group within the CIA led by George H.W. Bush. The Watergate coup served several purposes, but perhaps its most lasting impact was to ensconce George H.W. Bush as the new head of the cabal. George H.W. Bush's father was Prescott Bush, who was the best friend of Allen Dulles. Dulles dominated the CIA from 1953 until he was fired by JFK in the wake of the Bay of Pigs disaster. Like his father, George H.W. Bush was a graduate of Yale and a member of Skull and Bones. In a world where connections and pedigree mattered, George H.W. Bush was the crown prince within the CIA. The first stages of the Watergate coup involved creating a fake scandal to force the resignation of Vice President Spiro Agnew. With Agnew out of the way, the Watergate coup plotters were free to place one of their own in position to take the presidency. Nixon wanted to appoint John Connally of Texas as vice president, but Connally was not a cabal member, so the Republican establishment loyal to Bush threatened to block Connally's nomination, and Nixon was forced to pick a vice president acceptable to the cabal. Gerald Ford, as a member of the Warren Commission, had played a key role in covering up the coup of 63. Ford was not an inner circle member of the cabal behind the coup of 63, but he was solidly aligned with them and could be counted on to support and enable the secret government structures buried within the national security state. The Watergate burglars themselves were headed by CIA agent E. Howard Hunt. Hunt had been a key operational player in the coup of 63. He was even clearly photographed as one of the three tramps arrested near Dealey Plaza immediately after the shooting of JFK. On his deathbed, Hunt confessed to his involvement in the coup of 63 and named LBJ as the leader of the plot. To execute the Watergate break-in, Hunt rounded up some old Cuban comrades who had also been active in supporting JFK's assassination. To those in the know, the makeup of the Watergate burglars was a clear signal that Watergate was a plot on behalf of the cabal behind the coup of 63. To execute the disinformation campaign surrounding Watergate, the Watergate coup plotters turned to ex-naval intelligence officer Bob Woodward, who'd been inserted into the Washington Post. Woodward then proceeded to craft a series of stories that make up much of the myth of Watergate that we know today. In order to complete the takedown of Nixon, the president had to be denied the due process which could have allowed him an effective legal defense before the House Judiciary Committee, where the impeachment resolutions regarding Watergate had been referred. At this time, in 1973, a young Hillary Clinton was working as a staff lawyer for the committee. Even this early in her career, Clinton showed her willingness to ally herself with powerful, corrupt interests. Clinton, along with several other staff members of the committee, conspired to deny Nixon access to legal counsel. In order to pull this off, Hillary wrote a fraudulent legal brief and confiscated public documents to hide her deception. Her boss, Jeffrey Zeifman, later fired Hillary for her unethical actions and said about Hillary, quote, "She was a liar. She was an unethical, dishonest lawyer. She conspired to violate the Constitution, the rules of the House, the rules of the committee, and the rules of confidentiality." Unquote. The Ford Administration. Surrounded by enemies and facing a concerted pressure campaign, Nixon agreed to resign, thus putting Gerald Ford in the White House. Ford populated his administration with men committed to empowering and protecting the secret government. Dick Cheney served as Ford's chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense, and George H.W. Bush was made head of the CIA. This group would assume leadership roles in the secret government infrastructure. George H.W. Bush, more than any individual, assumed responsibility for maintaining the evil secrets of the coup of 63 and the waves of criminality that ensued. Bush took control of a CIA which was under siege. Congressional investigations by the Pike and Church committees had led to revelations about many of the dark secrets within the CIA. Congressional and public pressure demanded reform at the CIA. Despite his decades-long involvement as a deep CIA insider, Bush was falsely brought in as an outsider who would reform the CIA. Bush's real job was to staunch the flow of secrets out of the CIA and prevent the exposure of the truly explosive evil truths of the now multiple coups d'état executed by the CIA. Bush was able to stabilize the secret government mechanisms within the CIA, but the ongoing pressure for reform made the CIA an unsafe base from which to work. Backlash from Watergate was creating a political reform movement that was hard to stop, so the decision was made to move the many mechanisms of the secret government into the private sector. A large private intelligence industry was created and populated by ex-CIA men. David Attlee Phillips, who played a key operational role in the coup of 63, took early retirement from the CIA in 1975 and formed the Association of Retired Intelligence Officers, which served in some ways as a trade association for cabal members. George H.W. Bush serves as the chairman of the Honorary Board of Directors. In the 1976 presidential election, government reform backlash propelled Jimmy Carter into office. As president, Carter purged the CIA of its top 400 officers, and for the first time since its creation in 1947, a high level of scrutiny kept the CIA from operating out of control. Deprived of its main base within the government, the Cabal, now under the leadership of George H.W. Bush, worked primarily out of a network of private and international organizations. Key among these organizations was the Safari Club, a working group of international intelligence agencies. The network of ex-CIA agents who had participated in the coup of 63 was able to continue their unsupervised extra-governmental work through this network of intelligence agencies. The creation of the Safari Club coincided with the consolidation of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the BCCI, nicknamed the Bank of Crooks and Criminals. In addition to laundering money, the BCCI served as an intelligence-gathering mechanism by virtue of its extensive contacts with underground and underworld organizations worldwide. The Carter Administration and the Republican Counter-Surprise. During the Carter administration, the Cabal spent much effort on a series of rearguard actions to keep the truth about their domestic assassinations from being recognized. Forces battling for justice against the Cabal were able to launch the United States House of Representatives Select Committee on Assassinations, the HSCA, which operated from 1976 to 78. Despite fairly effective efforts within Congress to sabotage the HSCA, the HSCA did pose large problems for the Cabal. Honest investigators within the HSCA were more or less on the trail of the conspirators in JFK's killing. Many individuals involved in the coup of 63 were scheduled to testify before the HSCA. In order to prevent these actors from testifying, the death squads operated by the Cabal worked overtime. 21 people involved in the coup who were subpoenaed to testify before the committee died under mysterious circumstances. Many died just before their scheduled testimony. For example, in 1977, 7 senior FBI officials called to testify at the HSCA died within a 6-month period. Licking their wounds and biding the time, the power control group, now under the direction of George H.W. Bush, worked to retake control of the presidency. George H.W. Bush was such a pivotal figure because he bridged two separate worlds. He was a deep CIA insider, a lifelong intelligence operative, and he also came from an elite family and was intimately tied to the East Coast business elite. His father, Prescott, had been managing partner at the Wall Street investment bank Brown Brothers Harriman, and also a U.S. senator. The Bush and Rockefeller families were very close. George H.W.'s grandfather Samuel had been business partners with John D. Rockefeller's brother, and over the generation the Bush and Rockefeller clans had remained close. Empowered with these dual networks, George H.W. Bush could work within the dark nether realms of the intelligence community, as well as the Republican power elite. After Ronald Reagan defeated Bush in the Republican primary, Bush's powerful allies worked to get him chosen for the Republican vice presidential candidate. Reagan did not like Bush and did not want him as vice president, but David Rockefeller and the Republican establishment made it clear to Reagan that their backing for him depended upon him accepting Bush as his running mate. As the 1980 presidential election rolled around, the now Bush-led Cabal worked to prevent Carter's re-election. During 1980, the 52 Americans held hostage by Iran hung like a dark cloud over the Carter administration. Carter was working desperately to have the hostages returned. The Republicans feared a pre-election release of the hostages would give Carter a huge popularity boost and lead to his re-election. A last-minute event of significance before an election is known as an October surprise. In order to prevent this October surprise, The CIA old boy network associated with the cabal sabotaged Carter's attempts to rescue the hostages, and also sabotaged Carter's secret negotiations with the Iranians, and offered the Iranians an even better deal. Old-school CIA operative Bill Casey led negotiations with the Iranians, in which the cabal agreed to pay the Iranians $40 million and to ship billions of dollars of weapons stolen from the U.S. military stockpiles in Europe to the Iranians in exchange for the Iranians holding the hostages until Reagan became president. The Republican counter-surprise operation demonstrated the capabilities of the forces of the secret government to operate counter to the legal chain of command. The secret network of individuals within the CIA and military who were loyal to a parallel reporting hierarchy created logistical supply chains from Europe to Iran and looted billions of dollars of weapons from the NATO weapons stores under orders of people who were nominally just civilians. The Iranians were not content to accept Bill Casey as a high enough authority to seal the deal. They demanded to meet with either Reagan or Bush, so George H.W. Bush flew to Paris for face-to-face meetings with the Iranians to close the deal. Pressed for time because of a speaking engagement back in Washington, D.C., Bush returned from Paris in the world's fastest plane, an SR-71, which refueled over the Atlantic and got him home in time for his talk. The Republican counter-surprise came very close to being exposed, and once again the hit squads were active, killing many operatives who had the misfortune of being involved in this latest act of treason on Bush's part. In addition to assuring that the Republicans would occupy the White House, the Republican counter-surprise served another very important purpose. By agreeing to go along with the counter-surprise operation, Reagan compromised himself. Reagan had now acquiesced to committing an act of treason. By committing this crime, Reagan was now in no position to push back against other crimes by members of the cabal, because now he risked exposure himself if the mechanisms of the secret government were disclosed. The Reagan Administration. Within an hour of Reagan being sworn in as president, the Iranians released the hostages. As vice president, George H.W. Bush was able to assume unprecedented control over the national security infrastructure without Reagan understanding what was happening. Republican CIA counter-surprise point man William Casey was rewarded for his act of treason by being made director of the CIA. With Bush as vice president, Cheney as DCI, and Reagan dozing on the job, the cabal was well positioned to run the country behind the scenes. As vice president, Bush represented the United States on a committee of heads of international intelligence agencies. This working group had the capability to task a number of assassination teams for a variety of intelligence agencies. Without any formal or legal oversight, this committee had the power to kill with impunity nearly anyone in the world. Just 2 months into the Reagan administration, John Hinckley Jr. attempted to kill Ronald Reagan. There is good reason to believe that this planned assassination was another attempted coup d'etat. The Bush and Hinckley families were close. The day after the assassination attempt, John Hinckley's brother, Scott, was scheduled to have dinner with the Vice President Bush's son, Neil. In addition, earlier in his career, John Hinckley Sr., the gunman's father, worked for World Vision, an organization with close ties to the intelligence community. The Enterprise. Ensconced in the Vice President's office, Bush set out to build a criminal organization without parallel in U.S. history. Many elements of this criminal organization later became known under various names: Iran-Contra, the Savings and Loan Scandal, CIA-DEA drug trafficking, the HUD fraud, etc. However, the press reports either failed to comprehend or failed to report the common organization behind these crimes. Iran-Contra conspirator General Richard Secord called it the Enterprise, and that term perhaps best describes the organization. The Enterprise was a massive 5,000-person large hierarchical criminal organization with George H.W. Bush as its CEO.
The Enterprise was a multifaceted criminal conglomerate that ran a large number of criminal activities, including drug trafficking, arms trafficking, savings and loan fraud, securities fraud, oil and gas fraud, insurance fraud, and real estate fraud. Embedded within the national security infrastructure and protected from prosecution by corrupted enforcement agencies like the SEC, the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, etc., the Enterprise embarked on a massive criminal romp. Senior members of the Enterprise included William Casey, Richard Secord, Richard Armitage, Oliver North, John Poindexter, Edwin Wilson, Thomas Kleins, Donald Gregg, and Felix Rodriguez. During this time, the transition of the Cabal to an increasingly Bush family-centered syndicate continued. Much like a mob family, the next generation of the Bush family was brought into the family crime business. Members of the younger generation of the Bush family specialized in particular types of fraud. George W. Bush's speciality was insurance fraud. Neil Bush specialized in real estate fraud. Jeb Bush was involved in a wider variety of frauds: banking, securities, real estate, oil and gas, gold bullion, and aircraft brokerage funds. As with all George H.W. Bush operations, the Enterprise served many purposes. The most obvious motive was pure greed. Billions of dollars were plundered in a wide variety of frauds and crimes. But more importantly, Bush and the Cabal needed to spread and perpetuate a criminal milieu within government. An honest government was an enormous threat to Bush and the Cabal. They had, and have, a never-ending need to continue to commit more crimes in order to create new generations of criminals to maintain the criminal environment which protected them. Crime was the Bush family business. Just as Prescott Bush inducted George H.W. to the criminal life partially to protect himself from exposure of his World War II-era treason, fraud, and theft, George H.W. committed his sons to a life of crime so that the next generation would do their duty to protect their father and their family's criminal past. The financial frauds conducted by the Enterprise were designed to implicate, enrich, and entrap a huge swath of the political class in D.C. Fraudulent securities or oil and gas deals were offered to friends to enrich them and enemies to entrap them. In some cases, enemies were suckered in with easy profits on small investments, only to be bankrupted when larger fraudulent investments imploded. By the time that the Iran-Contra scandal made the headlines, such a large number of congressmen and D.C. insiders were implicated that any attempt to expose the scale of the scandal would have resulted in a near wholesale implication of the political class. In many ways, this endemic corruption is what makes political reform in Washington so difficult. The level of corruption is so pervasive that the political class has no choice but to cover for each other's crimes or risk mutually assured destruction. George H.W. Bush was the greatest criminal mastermind in American history. His criminal operations work on many, many levels. In addition to pure looting, the building and strengthening of his criminal base within government, and the systematic corruption control of political class in Washington, the Iran-Contra operation served another, little-understood purpose. Eventually, the large-scale looting of the savings and loans, the securities fraud, the oil and gas frauds, the insurance frauds, all began to come to light, and the end of the Enterprise was clearly in sight. At this point, an attempt was made to deliberately expose some drug and gun-running aspects of the Enterprise and to blame them on Reagan in an attempt to force him to resign. The falsely blaming the President for crimes with which he was not associated has strong parallels to the Watergate coup and makes Iran-Contra the fourth coup attempt in George H.W. Bush's career. However, Reagan loyalists Edwin Meese and George Shultz were able to fight off the coup, and Reagan's presidency survived. One reason that understanding the Enterprise is important today is that the network of people involved in the Enterprise did not go away. These individuals continued their long, active criminal careers, and some of the people responsible for the 9/11 operation can be found to have previous working relationships during the days of the Enterprise. As the large variety of crimes associated with the enterprise came to light, the press reported on a variety of scandals senior leadership of the enterprise needed to insulate themselves from exposure. The tactic they used to protect the upper management of the enterprise was the systematic killing of a huge number of middle-level players in the enterprise. In all, over 400 people were killed in the cover-up of the crimes of the enterprise. The vast majority of those killed were mid-level operational members of the enterprise, but a fair number of reporters were also killed to keep the true nature of the organization from being exposed. In order to facilitate the cover-up, Congress began an investigation by establishing the House Select Committee to investigate covert arms transactions with Iran. The most important figure on the committee was senior Republican member Richard Cheney. As a result, George H. W. Bush was totally exonerated by the final report. Bill Clinton. One part of the enterprise's criminal portfolio was drug trafficking. The CIA has had a long history of involvement in the drug business, going back to its post-World War II relationship with the Marseille Heroin Syndicate. As a side note, the CIA-Marseille Mafia relationship was leveraged to recruit Lucien Sarti, one of the gunmen behind the Grassy Knoll in Dallas. During the Vietnam War, the majority of the heroin supply in Vietnam and the Golden Triangle was controlled and trafficked under the supervision of the CIA. During the mid-1980s, the primary transshipment point for CIA military drug trafficking was Mena, Arkansas. Under the Enterprise, George H. W. Bush was the drug lord of the United States, and Governor Bill Clinton was the Arkansas state representative of the Enterprise. This criminal alliance between Bush and Clinton provided the basis for Clinton's rise to national prominence. In addition, a number of financial and oil and gas frauds were run out of Arkansas, with Hillary Clinton acting as counsel to several bogus corporations. From a young age, Bill Clinton had known that the path to power was through winning the favor of the rich and powerful men who controlled the power structure. In 1968, while at Oxford, ambitious young Bill Clinton was recruited as a CIA asset by CIA London Station Chief Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was a very significant figure in the coup of 63, when he ran the media cover-up, propaganda side of the coup. The cabal was always looking to groom a next generation of members, and from the point of view of the CIA cabal, Clinton must have made an ideal target. He was smart, charismatic, ambitious, and he couldn't keep his dick in his pants. That combination of traits made him very controllable. Clinton's rise to prominence within Arkansas politics was financed by a network of Arkansas organized crime figures prominent in the illegal gambling and drug money laundering business. Many members of Clinton's inner circle were involved in the money laundering and drug running businesses, and Clinton was easily drawn into supporting and protecting the illegal CIA-sponsored drug and gun running based in Arkansas. By participating in these criminal acts, Clinton earned his right to join the cabal, and he was rewarded by having the Bush Syndicate use their influence to promote him on the national stage. The cabal transcends any political party. The cabal is always looking to penetrate and control both political parties. So, during the 1992 presidential elections, the cabal couldn't lose. Cabal leader George H. W. Bush had the Republican nomination, and compromised junior cabal member Clinton was the Democratic candidate. Despite his corrupt stewardship of Arkansas, and despite his willingness to ally himself with criminal scumbags, when Clinton did attain the presidencies, his policies were relatively solid, and his administration was not nearly the kleptocracy of the Bushes or LBJ. However, since both Bill and Hillary had criminal backgrounds in drug running, money laundering, and financial fraud that intertwined with the enterprise, Clinton was obligated to maintain the large network of people committed to covering up high-level government-embedded crime by carrying over the appointments of over 1,000 Bush appointees who had been placed throughout the federal government for the reason of covering up the crimes of the enterprise. Clinton's administration was indicative of the limited potential for political change in D.C., without confronting the deep-seated problems of the secret government. Under Clinton, marginal management improvements were made within the federal government, and new criminal and imperialistic ventures were kept to a minimum. But the fundamental capabilities of the power control group were not challenged, and the criminal structures of the secret government worked quietly, waiting for the next member of the Bush syndicate to take office. What started for me as a study of the assassination of JFK continued to move forward in time. I had stumbled upon the Watergate coup while researching George H.W. Bush's involvement in the coup of 63 by reading Russ Baker's excellent book, Family of Secrets. This discovery sent me on a tangent of researching Watergate that lasted over 6 months. Then I bumped into The Enterprise while reading Defrauding America by Rodney Stitch, while tracking down a reference to a CIA recording of J. Edgar Hoover talking to Nelson Rockefeller about the planned killing of JFK. Defrauding America is a book that every American citizen should read. I found it painful to read, and in the course of reading it, I had to stop 3 times to take a break because I found its contents so disturbing. Even though I already knew that America had suffered 2 secret coups d'etat, I still did not understand the level of criminalization of the federal government. I didn't understand that significant elements of the judiciary were corrupt too. I didn't know that American jails held American citizens as political prisoners. Each of these discoveries was painful for me to accept. Defrauding America led me to the crucial insight that George H.W. Bush was the kingpin of the cabal, and I got a sense for the sophistication and complete amorality of his operations. By combining what I learned from Defrauding America with a bit that I knew about the FBI's cover-up of investigations into 9/11, I had a hunch that 9/11 was a Bush syndicate operation, and that hunch led me to spend much of the last 18 months studying 9/11 and a number of other acts of terrorism and the post-9/11 activity of the cabal. The Oklahoma City bombing. The next government-sponsored terrorist attack to be falsely blamed on the militia movement was the Oklahoma City bombing. A combination of domestic and international intelligence agencies inserted agents provocateurs into local militia groups. The agents provocateurs managed to motivate the otherwise harmless militia groups into enough action that they provided an adequate front for the Oklahoma City bombing. The actual bombing was a professional job that involved wiring parts of the Murrow office building with explosives and parking a truck with military-grade explosives, much, much more powerful than the crude fertilizer bombs that Timothy McVeigh supposedly built. The ATF staff located in the Murrow office building in Oklahoma City received advance word of the bombing and did not show up at the office that day. However, this advance warning was not passed to the people running the daycare center in the building, and 19 children under the age of 6 were among the 168 people killed. Timothy McVeigh was the patsy in this attack. The OKC bombing served at least 2 purposes. It removed public sympathy for the militia movement that had grown after the Waco attacks, and it destroyed an FBI investigation being run out of the Murrow building that would have exposed certain elements of the enterprise. Another result of the OKC bombing was that the militia movement was so weakened that it could no longer serve as an adequate basis for fake terror attacks. Now, the style changes here. It's quite clearly a work in progress. There's a few isolated notes, but I'm going to skip over. There's a section heading called the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So Mark Gordon clearly suspects that that was another inside job. And the next complete section, 9/11 overview. As I researched the elements surrounding 9/11, it didn't take me long to recognize that the official story of 9/11 was a cover-up for a much darker truth. By the time I started studying the 9/11 attacks, I had a good deal of experience studying domestic criminal operations masterminded by George H.W. Bush. I had an appreciation of the many levels on which his plots work, and the sheer breadth and scope of them. I was already familiar
with many black op techniques, security pullbacks, congressional investigations as part of a domestic plot, a secret government, etc. So I was well equipped to be able to start my investigation into 9/11. Yet, despite my knowledge of the criminal cabal embedded within our government, for the first 11 years after 9/11, it never occurred to me that there might be anything more to the story of 9/11 than the standard story believed by most Americans. Now, after a year and a half of research, I understand the basic structure and many of the elements of the 9/11 plot. However, the 9/11 plot is still relatively young and fresh, and no doubt revelations will continue for the next 50 years. Much of the detail of the events surrounding the coup of 63 has only come to light in the last 10 or 20 years, as many people who kept silent for decades slowly felt comfortable telling their stories, and long classified records came to light. 9/11 was a massive operation, and only the most visible elements of the plot have been investigated. But despite the mass of information yet to be discovered, enough information exists to clearly demonstrate that 9/11 was a massive, domestic-run black op. The key players behind 9/11 were the Bush family, George H.W., George W. and Marvin, and perhaps others, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, the neocons surrounding PNAC, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, Richard Armitage, Saudi Prince Bandar, Saudi intelligence and senior Saudi leadership, elements within the CIA, the FBI, and the ISI, that's Pakistani intelligence. Saudi government involvement in the 9/11 attacks. Superficially, the story behind the 9/11 attacks is that a group of Muslim fundamentalists hijacked planes and crashed them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. However, a deeper look shows these hijackers to be puppets manipulated by a series of intelligence agencies, and these intelligence agencies are then connected to the global criminal syndicate centered upon the Bush family and the Saudi leadership. The 2002 congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks contained a section named Specific Sources of Foreign Support for the Hijackers. President Bush censored these 28 full pages from the report. In 2013, after great effort, Representatives Walter Jones and Stephen Lynch were allowed to read the classified section. They said they were, quote, absolutely shocked at levels of foreign state involvement in the attacks. The hijackers were funded by Saudi and Pakistani intelligence. The wife of Saudi Prince Bandar sent checks totaling $130,000 to Saudi agents that was then funneled to the hijackers. But beyond the funding, the hijackers required operational support in order to be able to pull off the hijackings. All along the way, the hijackers had their hands held by either Saudi or Pakistani operatives. Senator Bob Graham, who co-headed the 2002 joint congressional inquiries into the 9/11 attacks, filed a sworn affidavit in 2012, which said, quote, I am convinced that there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out the September 11th attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia, unquote. Eckhard Werterbach, former head of Germany's domestic intelligence service, said, quote, such a sophisticated operation would require the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization, something not found in a loose group like the one led by the student Mohammed Atta in Hamburg, unquote. The rulers of Saudi Arabia are very conservative. They are among the very richest people on the planet. Saudi Arabia is a very close ally to the US. The Saudi ambassador to the US from 1983 to 2005 was Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Prince Bandar was so close to George H.W. Bush that he was often described as a member of the former president's family and was given the nickname Bandar Bush. So why would the rulers of Saudi Arabia risk bringing the wrath of the US down upon them by attacking a close ally? How could the rulers of Saudi Arabia be certain that in the days after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush would open the closed U.S. airspace to only allow flights of senior Saudis, including relatives of Osama bin Laden, to leave the country without being questioned. How could the rulers of Saudi Arabia know that the Bush administration would suppress, censor, and downplay information related to Saudi government involvement in the 9/11 attacks? How could the Saudi rulers be certain that the Bush administration would commit acts of treason to protect an enemy state that attacked America? The answer to these questions is that the Saudi rulers would never have risked such a foolhardy attack without the prior knowledge, consent, and support of President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and the people around them. Attacking America was the one thing that could have displaced the rulers of Saudi Arabia from their extremely cushy spot, awash in oil, cash, palaces, power, and women. The Saudi rulers would have needed great assurances that their complicity in these attacks would not have been allowed to blow back at them. A further examination of evidence surrounding the 9/11 attacks will show that 9/11 was a Bush syndicate plot in which the Saudis were complicit, rather than the Saudi plot in which the Bush syndicate was complicit. Al-Qaeda. The popular perception of Al-Qaeda is that its members were crazy zealots in a holy war against the United States. But historically, Al-Qaeda has functioned more like a freelance mercenary army, guided by the CIA through the proxies of the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence services. Al-Qaeda evolved out of the CIA-funded Mujahideen army that fought the Soviets in the 1980s in Afghanistan. After driving the Soviets from Afghanistan, the radical fundamentalist Mujahideen fighters were reorganized under the banner of Al-Qaeda and were employed as mercenaries on behalf of the US and Saudi oil companies and the CIA fighting proxy wars against Russian influence in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kosovo, and Azerbaijan. Al-Qaeda's actions served to destabilize Central Asia and shift control of the natural resources of Central Asia from Russian to US and Saudi control. A key organization guiding the US effort to control the oil and gas of Azerbaijan was the US-Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, whose members included Dick Cheney, Richard Armitage, Richard Perle, and James Baker IV. The core of the 9/11 operation centered around the Bush Syndicate and the leaders of the Saudi government and intelligence agencies. This network of individuals had been working together since the mid-1970s and the formation of the Safari Club. The Saudi-US intelligence cabal was involved in the CIA Republican counter-surprise, Iran-Contra, BCCI, and numerous oil and gas deals throughout the Middle East, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. Saudi intelligence operatives paved the way for the hijackers by setting up apartments, providing phones, paying rent, setting up meetings to get the hijackers established in America. The hijackers were shepherded and guided around the US by Saudi intelligence agents and their allies in the US. In addition, many of the flight schools at which the pilot hijackers attended were owned by people with connections to Saudi intelligence. The hijackers were also supported by the Pakistani government. Director General of the ISI, that's Pakistan's CIA, Lieutenant General Mahmoud Ahmed, ordered $100,000 transferred to the account of Mohammed Atta, one of the lead coordinators of the hijackers. As an interesting side note, at the time of the 9/11 attacks, General Mahmoud was meeting with Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss, who would both go on to head the first congressional 9/11 investigation. Porter Goss was a CIA covert operative who worked closely with many people involved in the coup of 63. The stripping of anti-terror protections. The popular myth about 9/11 states that the hijackers were able to roam free in the United States for years, planning their attacks without law enforcement agencies noticing them or doing anything. But a closer examination of the facts shows many law enforcement personnel identified the hijackers, tried to stop them, but were restrained by anti-terror officials high up in the FBI and CIA. The FBI and CIA groups nominally responsible for stopping Al-Qaeda instead worked to facilitate the hijackers' free operation in the US. Based within the CIA's Get Al-Qaeda unit, ALEC station, and the FBI's Radical Fundamentalist unit, criminal members of the secret government were perfectly positioned to guide and shelter the Al-Qaeda penetration of America. If normal policies regarding State Department terror watch lists were allowed to function as designed, few, if any, of the hijackers would have been able to even enter the United States. However, the CIA both facilitated the granting of visas to known or potential terrorists and also repeatedly prevented known terrorists from being put on terror watch lists that would have kept them out of the country. J. Michael Springman, former U.S. consulate visa officer in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, put it succinctly when he said, quote, "The CIA forced me to allow terrorists into the U.S." unquote. Within the CIA, the ALEC station group was dedicated to focusing on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Senior members of ALEC station, including Tom Wilshire, Richard Blee, and Alfreda Bikowski, all committed multiple acts of treason by frustrating the elements of honest law enforcement officials to stop the 9/11 plot. The members of ALEC station not only sabotaged efforts by FBI agents desperate to stop known terrorists from entering the US, but they created a fake cover story to hide their criminal actions, showing that this active enabling of terrorists was not incompetence but deliberate support of the terrorist plots. Although the CIA suppression of anti-terror efforts was centered around ALEC station, the failure to pursue terrorists and the protection of terrorists was carried out by multiple CIA stations, indicating high-level support for these actions. In 1999 to 2000, Able Danger, a military intelligence program which mined publicly available data, identified two operational Al-Qaeda cells preparing for the 9/11 attacks. U.S. Special Operations Command, SOCOM, began preparations to take action against these terrorist cells. However, in October of 2000, CIA Director George Tenet faced off against Army General Bob Hardy Jr. in a closed session before the House Intelligence Committee and forced the cancelling of the Able Danger program and the SOCOM attempts to take down the Al-Qaeda cells. George Tenet was CIA Director from 1997 to 2004. Prior to taking the helm at the CIA, Tenet served as Deputy Director. Tenet cultivated close personal relationships with officials in Saudi Arabia, particularly Prince Bandar, whose wife funded the hijackers. As Deputy Director of the CIA in 1996, Tenet installed one of his closest friends, John Brennan, as CIA Station Chief in Saudi Arabia. In this role, Brennan often communicated directly with Tenet, avoiding the usual chain of command. Under Tenet's leadership, the CIA trumpeted the terrorist threat while repeatedly failing to pursue and actively sabotaging opportunities to capture or stop terrorists. Counter-terrorism czar Richard Clarke was close friends with the royal family of the United Arab Emirates, who created the BCCI terrorist network. Clark was behind the failure of two CIA attempts to capture or kill bin Laden in 1999. He effectively opposed a CIA request to attack a training camp where bin Laden had been located, and the next month, when the CIA was preparing to take out bin Laden during an Afghanistan hunting trip, committing an act of treason, Clark informed his UAE friends about the CIA plans. The UAE royals tipped off bin Laden, and the US lost another opportunity to take out Osama bin Laden. The FBI played a key role in allowing the 9/11 attacks to take place, with responsibility for overseeing terrorist investigations. Having FBI involvement was key to allowing the 9/11 attacks to take place. Numerous examples exist of the FBI failing to take the appropriate action to follow up on clear evidence of brewing terrorist plots or actually sabotaging investigations by honest investigators within the FBI. Below is just a small sample of some of the many warnings and leads. In November of 2000,
Dr. David Graham of Shreveport met with 9/11 hijackers Nawaf al-Hazmi and Fayez Bani Hamad. After suspecting Mohammed Jamal Khan, al-Hazmi, and Bani Hamad of preparing for a terrorist attack, Dr. Graham contacted the FBI. The FBI responded by making threatening comments to Graham and suggesting that he might be killed for reporting Jamal Khan. During the 2002 to 2004 period, Dr. Graham worked to investigate the terrorist activity in Shreveport, and he wrote a book, The 9/11 Graham Report. The FBI strongly urged Graham to not publish his book, and when he did, Graham was poisoned. After being poisoned, and before his death, Dr. Graham indicated that he thought the FBI was behind his poisoning. On August 16, 2001, the FBI field office in Minneapolis arrested Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, after learning of his plans to hijack a jetliner and use it for a terrorist attack. The FBI Minneapolis field office tried like hell to follow up on this arrest, but were repeatedly stopped by the FBI's Radical Fundamentalist Unit in D.C. The unit's sabotage of this terrorist investigation went on for weeks, involved multiple people, and included threatening the careers of Minneapolis FBI agents who tried to pursue the investigation. In April 2000, Niaz Khan told the FBI that he was recruited by Al-Qaeda and trained to hijack planes and sent to the U.S. for a terror mission along with several pilots. FBI agents in Newark, New Jersey, interviewed Khan for 3 weeks, gave Khan a polygraph, which he passed. The FBI agents believed Khan's story and aggressively tried to follow up, but word came down from FBI headquarters saying, quote, "Return him to London and forget about it," unquote. On July 10, 2001, FBI Special Agent Kenneth Williams, stationed in Phoenix, sent a memo to headquarters to, quote, "advise the Bureau and New York of the possibility of a coordinated effort by Osama bin Laden to send students to the United States to attend civil aviation universities and colleges. Phoenix has observed an inordinate number of individuals of investigative interest who are attending or who have attended civil aviation universities and colleges in the state of Arizona," unquote. But although this memo was seen by at least a dozen FBI officials, nothing was done to follow up. Honest FBI agents who did not get the message that they were not to interfere with terrorists operating in the U.S. were driven out of the FBI. John O'Neill, the FBI's best al-Qaeda expert, was harassed by a pointless investigation into a briefcase with classified information that he misplaced for a couple of hours over a year earlier. The briefcase was locked and never touched. This investigation prevented him from stopping al-Qaeda and forced him into retirement. FBI informant Janet Parker said of the FBI, quote, "O'Neill's own bureau blocked him every step of the way," unquote. Parker also recalls, during the months before 9/11, O'Neill telling her that someone higher up had blocked attempts to wiretap terrorist suspects, refused to let him return to Yemen, mysteriously deleted all his files at FBI New York headquarters, and then finally relegated him to a desk job far away from the front lines of terrorism. The FBI and CIA support for terrorism extended beyond suppressing anti-terror investigations to include operational support for terrorist attacks. Islamic terrorist Ali Mohammed at various times worked for the FBI, the CIA, and the U.S. Army. Mohammed was involved in training terrorists involved in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the New York Landmarks plot, and attacks against Americans in Somalia and Kenya. He trained terrorists on how to hijack planes, including how to smuggle box cutters on board. Despite Mohammed's record of known terrorist activities and being on the State Department watch list, Mohammed was repeatedly allowed to travel to and from America on what an FBI consultant called, quote, "a visa program controlled by the CIA," unquote. In 1993, Mohammed was arrested by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. but he was released at the request of the FBI, despite his confessed role in planning the 9/11 attacks. As of 2007, Mohammed had still not been sentenced for his involvement in these crimes. The crippling of U.S. air defenses. Most people have been given the idea that there was little the U.S. Air Force could have done to stop the hijacked airliners from crashing into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. However, intercepting the hijacked airliners would have been a simple, straightforward exercise for the U.S. Air Force. U.S. air defense planners had spent tens of thousands of man-years and hundreds of billions of dollars designing, developing, and deploying the U.S. domestic air defenses. For decades, the U.S. Air Force had been continually ready to intercept any threat that approached or entered U.S. airspace. As part of its standard operating procedures, the Air Force scrambled fighter jets whenever a jetliner went off course or radio contact with it was lost. In the year 2000, fighters were scrambled to intercept aircraft in response to 129 cases where problems were not immediately resolved. Given the capabilities of the U.S. air defenses and the relative ease of intercepting commercial airliners, the Bush-Cheney cabal had to work hard to cripple the U.S. air defenses. The two main organizations focused on protecting the U.S. from air attack were NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Both NORAD and the FAA were infiltrated by cabal members who proceeded to work to sabotage the U.S. air defenses from within. In addition, special attention was paid to jamming the communication interfaces between the FAA and NORAD. Key people were put in place at the FAA and NORAD, who took actions to reduce the effectiveness of the U.S. defenses, and then on September the 11th, 2001, these agents of the secret government, within the FAA and NORAD, repeatedly failed to respond to the hijackings, were absent, gave orders which paralyzed the fighter response, or sent fighters in the wrong direction. In order to dismantle the capabilities of the U.S. air defenses, on May the 8th, 2001, President Bush asked Dick Cheney to oversee the National Preparedness Review to evaluate and make recommendations to, quote, strengthen preparedness against acts of terrorism, unquote. In response to requests from the National Preparedness Review, on June the 1st, 2001, the Joint Chiefs of Staff issued a memo that overhauled long-established air defense protocols and required that the Secretary of Defense personally authorize any request for fighter intercept of hijacked airliners. This procedure change prevented the intercept of errant airliners that had been a regular occurrence. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bowman, former Director of Advanced Space Programs Development during the Ford and Carter administrations, and a former U.S. Air Force colonel who flew 101 combat missions, said in 2005, quote, "If our government had merely done nothing, and I say that as an old interceptor pilot, I know the drill, I know what it takes, I know how long it takes, I know what the procedures are, I know what they were, I know what they've changed them to. If our government had merely done nothing and allowed normal procedures to happen on that morning of 9/11, the Twin Towers would still be standing and thousands of dead Americans would still be alive." Unquote. Just as Bush took office, Lieutenant General Michael Canavan was placed in the role of hijack coordinator at the FAA. General Canavan had an unusual background for a hijack coordinator. Prior to taking the job of hijack coordinator, Canavan had been the center of the JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which ran the military's counter-terrorism operations and covert missions. In 1998, Canavan and JSOC undermined a CIA plan to capture Osama bin Laden. As hijack coordinator, Canavan ordered the cover-up of security weaknesses at airports, which eased the hijacker's ability to take over the planes. During the 9/11 attacks, Canavan was inexplicably absent from his job as hijack coordinator. Yet, despite his abysmal performance as hijack coordinator during the worst series of hijackings in U.S. history, just 2 days later, Canavan took part in a so-called Principals Committee meeting chaired by Condoleezza Rice, that included all of George W. Bush's so-called war cabinet. A key tool to confuse the U.S. air defenses and provide cover for the stand-down operation was the use of simulated training exercises. Training exercises are the perfect cover to operationalize real-life terrorist attacks, because they provide the opportunity to have people acting like terrorists and also doing things that terrorists might do. At the same time, these exercises confuse non-participants about whether events are real or simulations. In addition, some exercises were used to occupy resources that could have prevented the terrorist attacks with out-of-the-way training missions. Fighter aircraft that normally would have been situated along the eastern seaboard were sent to Alaska and northern Canada as part of Operation Northern Vigilance, which left air bases near New York and Washington short on fighter aircraft with which to respond to the hijackings. NORAD conducted an annual exercise called Vigilant Guardian. In previous years, Vigilant Guardian was held in late October, but in 2001, Vigilant Guardian was moved to the September 6th to the 11th time period. As part of Vigilant Guardian, false blips were inserted onto the radar screens of the FAA and NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector. Many FAA and Air Force personnel initially mistook the actual hijacked aircraft for simulated aircraft that were part of Vigilant Guardian. While fake radar tracks were inserted onto radar screens, real aircraft were allowed into restricted airspace under the pretext of another training exercise. Three E-4Bs and a militarized 747-200 were launched between 8:30 and 9 o'clock on September 11th as part of the Global Guardian exercise. On the day of September 11th, 2001, numerous examples exist of fighters not launched or launched from distant as opposed to closer air bases, and when launched were sent in the wrong direction or put in holding patterns. This sequence of multiple protocol failures and missteps could only have been accomplished by a large coordinated action involving many people scattered throughout NORAD and the FAA. Very senior people at both NORAD and the FAA had to have been knowingly involved in a stand-down operation. Dr. Stephen Pachinik, a former U.S. Navy captain who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Nixon, Ford, and Carter, and also won two prestigious Solomon Awards at the Harvard Medical School as he simultaneously completed a PhD at MIT, said, quote, 9/11 was called a stand-down, a false flag operation, in order to mobilize the American public under false pretenses. It was told to me even by the general on the staff of Wolfowitz. I will go in front of a federal committee and swear on perjury who the name was of the individual so we can break it open. Unquote. The World Trade Center building collapses. In addition to the two main World Trade Center towers, 1 and 2, World Trade Center 7 also collapsed on September the 11th. However, World Trade 7 was not hit by an airplane. World Trade 7 was brought down in a controlled demolition by explosives that had been planted inside the building prior to September the 11th. The official explanation for the collapse of World Trade 7 was that its steel skeleton was weakened by fire and collapsed. However, fire does not cause steel-framed buildings to collapse. The easiest proof of this fact can be found on the internet of pictures of giant steel-framed skyscrapers engulfed in flames. Some of these fires look to be 50 times larger than the World Trade Center 7 fire, yet after these fires have burned themselves out, the charred steel skeleton of the buildings are still standing. Quite simply, even raging office fires do not get hot enough to melt or weaken structural steel to the point at which the building will collapse. WTC 7 collapsed at a rate indistinguishable from free fall. An object can only fall freely in the absence of any force pushing against it. So the fact that World Trade 7 experienced free fall is evidence that it did not face any resistance as it fell, which is evidence that all resistance had been removed prior to the collapse. In any scenario where the collapse was caused by fires weakening the steel beams, the crumbling steel would still have slowed the collapse with some force, and the building would not have been able to accelerate without resistance. David Chandler has produced a very nice video which demonstrates this point. In addition to the physical evidence of a controlled demolition, the government cover-up of the World Trade Center 7 collapse is additional evidence of high-level government criminality. The official U.S. government investigation of the collapse was conducted by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. During the NIST investigation, they developed a computer model of how World Trade Center 7 collapsed. However, NIST will not release the input data in this model because doing so might jeopardize public safety. Danny Jawenko, one of the world's leading building demolition experts, said before he was killed in a 2011 car crash, quote, "I've looked at the drawings at the construction, and the World Trade Center 7 collapse couldn't be done by fire. This is a controlled demolition which was carried out by a team of experts." Unquote. Eyewitness testimony also points to internal explosions within WTC 7. One of the most compelling stories was told by Barry Jennings, who tells of being trapped in WTC 7 by explosions. However, these explosions occurred before the collapse of either World Trade Center 1 or 2. When Jennings agreed to tell his story to the filmmakers making the 9/11 film Loose Change, he received threats to his safety, and he died mysteriously 2 days before the release of the NIST report, which falsely claimed that there were no witnesses to explosions in World Trade Center 7. In addition to Building 7, World Trade Centers 1 and 2 were destroyed by explosives that had been installed within the buildings long before September the 11th. Detailed analysis of these collapses shows a large amount of proof for controlled demolition powered by nanothermite. I highly recommend watching David Chandler's videos pointing out overwhelming evidence of explosive demolition, including massive explosions occurring above the impact zone of the airplane, a rate of fall of the towers incompatible with a pancaking collapse theory, all of the debris spilling off the sides of the building reduced the mass of the material pushing down on the building, so the lower structure of the building is clearly experiencing less force pushing down upon it than normal, not some much greater force which might have crushed the building. Internal explosions occurring dozens of floors below the impact of the upper floors. These squibs are commonly seen in controlled demolitions. Waves of progressive explosions occurring before the collapse. Debris falling faster than free fall. Evidence of explosives accelerating this debris. Debris which changes direction in mid-air, which is evidence of explosives, and the disintegration of large chunks of the structure in mid-air, which could only have been accomplished by internal explosives. Aerosolized iron and nanothermite found in the dust. Analysis of the dust produced by the collapses of the World Trade Center towers has produced scientific evidence of the byproducts of a controlled demolition which could not have been produced from a jet-fueled office fire. In the WTC dust, both unexploded nanothermite as well as the chemical signature of burned nanothermite have been found in significant quantities. Nanothermite is a chemical compound that burns hotter than 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit and is commonly used in cutting charges, which are used to cut steel in controlled demolitions. Structural steel melts at 2,750. The World Trade Center fires produce temperatures of 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. In addition, superthermite is made by embedding tiny aluminium particles along with the iron oxide in regular thermite in a sol gel. Sol gels leave 1,3-diphenylpropane as a signature residue when they burn. EPA analysis of the WTC dust showed that one molecule was present at levels that dwarfed all others, 1,3-diphenylpropane. Eric Schwartz of the EPA also remarked that, quote, "We've never observed it in any other sampling we've ever done," unquote. Iron-rich microspheres were also present in the WTC dust. As vaporized steel cools in the air, it condenses as iron-rich microspheres. Burning thermite produces temperatures hot enough to vaporize steel, but even the hottest office fires do not get anywhere close to being hot enough to vaporize steel. Based on the amount of the metallic microspheres found in the WCC dust samples, the overall quantity of vaporized steel created by the demolition of the WTC towers is over 10 tons. WTC 1 and 2 were packed with absolutely massive amounts of explosives from top to bottom. They did not collapse under their own weight. They were blown to smithereens. Only the people and entities in charge of the World Trade Center complex had the access and control of the building to ensure the installation of this amount of explosives. Placing this large amount of explosives throughout the World Trade Center towers required a large construction project throughout the buildings. In order to create a pretext for a large, expensive amount of construction work, a rationale was needed. The 1993 World Trade Center bombing created the necessary pretext for a massive engineering upgrade of the World Trade Center complex. The purpose of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was not to bring down the World Trade Center. A truck bomb could not bring down a structure as large as the World Trade Center. The purpose of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was to create a rationale for a security upgrade of the World Trade Center complex. And for this purpose, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing succeeded perfectly. According to Alan Rice, the Port Authority's World Trade Center director, quote, "After the 1993 bombing, we implemented a 10-year redevelopment program. We were spending $500 million on upgrades. It was an engineer's dream," unquote. After the 1993 bombing, the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, brought in Kroll Associates to do a complete security analysis. The executive director of the Port Authority emphasized the importance of Kroll's work at the World Trade Center by saying, quote, "We have such confidence in Kroll that I have followed every one of their recommendations," unquote. The person who led Kroll's work on the World Trade Center was Brian Michael Jenkins. Jenkins is an absolutely key figure for understanding the core of the 9/11 operation. From 1989 to 1998, Jenkins was the deputy chairman of crisis management for Kroll. Kroll is a private intelligence company populated with former CIA spies and FBI agents. One of the key takeaways of understanding the key role that the 1993 World Trade Center bombing played in enabling the 9/11 attacks is that it highlights how long the 9/11 op had been in the works. Planning for 9/11 and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing had been going on since 1991 at the latest, and much more likely, active planning for the 9/11 op can be dated back to the mid-80s. The roots of the terror scam. The national security state has always required an external threat to justify massive military and intelligence budgets, and the warlike mentality that does not allow questioning of state actions. Given the long history of criminal actions conducted out of the military intelligence complex, an outbreak of peace would be a grave threat to the criminal actors embedded within the national security state. A peaceful environment would allow records to be released and questions asked about where the money was spent, and national security would no longer be a valid reason to shut down criminal and civil investigations. As the Soviet Union collapsed in the late 1980s, the image of the Soviet Union as a threat to the US could no longer be maintained. National security planners had long been aware that terrorism was another threat that could be strategically used to justify a wartime posture. Around 1986, a group of people who would later play important roles in the 9/11 op coalesced around the issue of terrorism. Brian Michael Jenkins advised Secretary of State George Shultz on matters of terrorism. L. Paul Bremer became the new ambassador at large for counterterrorism, and Richard Armitage worked as the lead counterterrorism representative for the Department of Defense. These and other people worked on a long-term project to create from scratch a terrorist threat to the United States, where none existed before. The capstone of this 15-year project was the 9/11 attacks. One major problem with creating an Islamic terrorist threat in the US was that almost all the Muslims in the United States were peaceful people, not inclined to attack anyone. However, during the war in Afghanistan, the CIA had formed working alliances with some of the most extreme Muslim fundamentalists on the planet. Lacking Muslim extremists in the US to carry out terror attacks, the CIA imported them into the US. In the 1980s, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman was one of the most extreme advocates of Islamic violence in the world. Between 1986 and 1990, CIA agents acting as consular officials at US embassies in Sudan and Egypt gave Abdul Rahman 6 different visas to enter the US. Once in the US, Abdul Rahman preached a theology of Muslim violence previously not found in the US. As another example, Muslim terrorist Ali Mohammed was admitted to the US under a special visa program controlled by the CIA's clandestine services. In the 1980s and 1990s, with the help of the CIA, many terrorists were repeatedly able to enter the US despite being on watch lists, or were not put on watch lists after committing multiple terrorist acts. As a result of the work done by Muslim extremists brought into the US by the CIA, by the early 1990s, a small violent group of Muslim extremists had been established in the US. Once in the US, US government agents such as Ali Mohammed and Emad Salem worked as agents provocateurs to guide the militant recruits towards particular operations. In tandem with manipulated front operations, sophisticated back-end support from intelligence agencies allowed for the execution of complex operations. I have seen no evidence linking George H.W. Bush directly to the 9/11 attacks. But, just as physicists can detect the presence of a black hole by the actions of other bodies around it, so the massive force of George H.W. Bush in the 9/11 op can be inferred. Many people extremely close to Bobby Bush were actively involved in the 9/11 op, including his oldest son, George W. Bush, his youngest son, Marvin Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Prince Bandar, the Iran-Contra Network, the BCCI Network. On September the 10th, 2001, George H.W. Bush was in Washington, D.C., where he attended the investor conference of the Carlyle Group, along with Osama bin Laden's brother, Shafiq bin Laden. Poppy Bush then spent the night of September the 10th at the White House, despite the fact that his son was in Florida. Poppy Bush was a master spy. He'd been at the heart of the CIA his entire career. In honor of his crucial role at the core of the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, is now named the George Bush Center for Intelligence. As a protege of Alan Dulles, Bush learned the tradecraft that kept him in the shadows and his crimes hard to detect. During his tenure as vice president under Reagan, Poppy Bush was head of the secret government apparatus. The networks of people involved in the 9/11 operation line up perfectly with Poppy Bush's own networks. The CIA, Saudi leadership, Saudi intelligence, Pakistani ISI, etc. These are the same networks that had been involved with Poppy Bush's previous criminal acts, the CIA Republican Counter-Surprise, Iran-Contra, BCCI, and Poppy Bush had been the prime mover in all of these operations. Whoever conceived the 9/11 attacks had to be a heartless killer. For years, Poppy Bush had been authorizing the killings of hundreds of innocent Americans to cover up his earlier crimes. From the early 1970s to the present day, Poppy Bush has owned the responsibility for covering up JFK's assassination, including the killing of many dozens of people. 400 were killed to cover up the enterprise Iran-Contra alone. Whoever planned the 9/11 op had to have the boldness to think that a massive crime could be committed in broad daylight. Most people could not even imagine daring to get away with such a crime, but Poppy Bush had decades of experience getting away with bold, high-profile crimes, from the coup of 63 to Watergate to the CIA Republican counter-surprise to Iran-Contra. After LBJ, Allen Dulles, and J. Edgar Hoover died, Poppy Bush assumed responsibility for the ongoing cover-up of the coup of 63. He would carry this responsibility with him for the rest of his life. He could never retire. The fear of exposure of his past crimes would haunt him every day. An outbreak of peace, a victory in the Cold War, presented a profound threat to his liberty. As head of the secret government, Poppy Bush had responsibility for ensuring that the US stay on a perpetual war footing, so that the crimes of the national security state would continue to be suppressed. The original planning for the 9/11 op occurred either during Bush's tenure as vice president or during his presidential administration. During the 1980s, Bush led the secret government apparatus buried within the national security state. The secret government had been functioning for decades and had the ability to operate outside the constitutional chain of command. Much of the execution of the 9/11 op occurred within the US government during the Clinton administration. Due to Clinton's complicity in the Contra drug trafficking and enterprise-related financial crimes, Clinton kept in office over 1,000 Bush appointees who helped keep these crimes under wraps. This same network of people played a crucial role in enabling 9/11 to happen, and this network was loyal to Poppy Bush. The 9/11 op needed to have a sympathetic president in the US in order to make it work. In this sense, 9/11 was a gift from father to son. Few other people could conceivably count on a future president being supportive of such a heinous crime. Poppy Bush operations worked on many levels and served many purposes. The 9/11 op has the hallmarks of a Poppy Bush operation. 9/11 helped create a permanent war on terror that has served as a justification for two imperialistic wars. It also enabled the Patriot Act and its massive expansion of government secrecy, which helps keep old crimes buried. 9/11 helped destroy a large number of criminal and civil investigations which would have led to the Bush Syndicate, and 9/11 justified a surge in military intelligence spending, much of which went into the pockets of Bush allies. In addition, many different types of financial crimes, insider trading, insurance fraud, money laundering, financial looting, were embedded within the plot. The 9/11 attacks as pretext to destroy criminal investigations. Destroying World Trade Center 7 had no public relations purpose for the Bush Syndicate. At 47 stories, most people were not even aware that it existed. Yet within World Trade Center 7 were many government offices, including the FBI, the CIA, the SEC, the Justice Department, and the Secret Service. World Trade Center 7 was also the storage facility for millions of files pertaining to active cases involving international drug dealing, organized crime, terrorism, and money laundering. By destroying World Trade Center 7, the Bush Syndicate was able to stop many criminal investigations that would have led to high-level members of the criminal cabal embedded within the US government. The need to avoid prosecution for previous crimes may have been one of the largest motivations for the 9/11 attacks. These investigations included World Trade Center Building 6, which housed the US Customs Agency, and the El Dorado Task Force, an interagency group founded in 1992, which coordinated all major money laundering investigations in the US. An FBI investigation into gold price fixing and gold laundering, housed on the 22nd floor on the North Tower in the World Trade Center. An FBI case against Mobil Oil and James Giffen on illegal oil swaps between Iran and Kazakhstan, at that time before a New York grand jury. Bank of New York, money laundering, evidence in Buildings 1 and 7. Three agencies involved in the Enron investigation, the SEC, the Justice Department, and the FBI. In World Trade Center 7, the IRS was investigating Barrick Gold's offshore hedge book. 3,000 to 4,000 cases at the SEC office, including documents showing the relationship between Citigroup and WorldCom. Instead of flying straight over the Potomac and into the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, American Airlines Flight 77 executed a very difficult 330-degree descending corkscrew to crash into the section of the Pentagon containing the Office of Naval Intelligence and Pentagon budget analysis. The Office of Naval Intelligence had just been moved into the section of the Pentagon which was destroyed on 9/11. At that time, the Office of Naval Intelligence was investigating a gold price fixing and gold laundering scheme that could have implicated the Bush Syndicate. Also killed in the Pentagon on 9/11 were a large number of budget analysts and accountants who may have been looking into the $2.3 trillion of unaccounted military spending that Donald Rumsfeld announced on September 10, 2001. In addition, after 9/11, many government investigators who previously had been looking into domestic government criminal activity were diverted from those cases to the newly created War on Terror, as a result of both the destruction of ongoing investigations and the diversion of resources. All investigations which threatened criminals embedded within the highest levels of the U.S. government were stopped. 9/11 as a massive financial crime. The criminal syndicate behind 9/11 also used the terrorist attacks as cover for a series of financial crimes. These crimes are less well researched than many other aspects of the 9/11 op, and I suspect that we'll have continuing revelations on this front. The best documented aspect of the financial crimes has been the widespread insider trading that took place prior to the 9/11 attacks. Jonathan Weiner, a financial consultant, told ABC, quote, "It's absolutely unprecedented to see cases of insider trading covering the entire world, from Japan to the US to North America to Europe," unquote. After the 9/11 attacks, the German central bank studied the possibility of insider trading. According to the German central bank president, Ernst Welticker, the German researchers found, quote, "almost irrefutable proof of insider trading," unquote. Welticker was blunt, quote, "What we found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy," unquote. Some of the unusual trading in put options was conducted by Deutsche Bank Alex Braun, whose CEO Buzzy Krongard had long-standing ties to the CIA, and left Alex Braun in March 2001 to become executive director of the CIA. However, the SEC was not forthcoming about its own investigation and treated these inquiries as if they were state secrets. The SEC quickly concluded that there was no insider trading and, in a highly unusual move, destroyed all of its records of the investigation. In addition to insider trading, other sophisticated financial frauds were part of the 9/11 op. Convar, a company specializing in computer disaster recovery, found evidence that unusually large sums of money, perhaps more than $100 million, were rushed through the computers in the World Trade Center as the disaster unfolded. A Deutsche Bank employee told investigative reporter Mike Ruppert that, quote, "about 5 minutes before the attack, the entire Deutsche Bank computer system had been taken over by something external that no one in the office recognized, and every file was downloaded at lightning speed to an unknown location," unquote. The details of what happened in the bond market are not completely clear, but there appears to be strong evidence that a major financial crime was committed, perhaps the largest theft in U.S. history. It's also possible that there is a benign explanation for the following set of facts, but given the level of sophistication and comprehensive nature of the Bush Syndicate, The benign explanation strikes me as unlikely. The targeted nature of the airplane strikes appears to have been a deliberate attempt to cause chaos in the US government bond market. The plane which hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center crashed right into the offices of Cantor Fitzgerald, the largest interdealer broker of US government bonds, while in the South Tower, the offices of Eurobrokers, another large interdealer broker, were in the impact zone of the second plane strike. In the wake of the chaos in the bond market, the regular rules for settling trades were suspended and the conditions for a huge financial crime were created. Trade breaks are a regular occurrence in the financial markets and standard procedures exist to allow for the nullification of trades without a counterparty. However, in the days following 9/11, rather than use the established procedures for dealing with unmatched trades, in an unprecedented action, the SEC suspended normal rules and allowed for blind brokered trades. Despite the damage to Lower Manhattan, the fixed income clearing operations of most banks were unaffected. But in the days following September the 11th, the Bank of New York was overdue on over $100 billion in payments. However, none of the Bank of New York systems failed or went non-operational. As the New York Times reported, quote, "Bank executives argue that some of the criticism has taken on some aspects of urban legend, especially the notion that the bank was in disarray because the main backup for its computer center in Lower Manhattan was at another location in Lower Manhattan. The bank says that all of its several computer centers in Manhattan were always set to revert to centers outside of the city in case of emergency, and they did on September the 11th." Unquote. September the 11th, 2001, was no ordinary day for the financial markets. By mid-morning, all of Lower Manhattan, including the financial district, had been evacuated. Across the country, business slowed as people put their normal lives on hold to either react to the attacks or just watch the events unfold on TV. As a result, both the number and volume of transactions sending funds through the financial system was much lower than average throughout the day of 9/11. However, starting at around 6 p.m. and continuing to midnight, a huge amount of money started flowing through the banking system. Although many billions of dollars were flowing through the system, this large flow of funds was handled with only a small number of transactions. What really happened in the financial markets in the days following 9/11 is hard to know, but evidence exists of highly unusual trade flows, an unprecedented suspension of the normal rules for processing trades, massive coordinated insider trading that was covered up by the SEC, an incredibly sophisticated black op run by people with a history of running financial frauds, a computer systems takeover at Deutsche Bank, and $100 billion-plus trade settlement problem at the Bank of New York, blamed on systems problems, yet the Bank of New York never had any systems problems. Given the lack of any investigation into these possible financial crimes, not enough evidence exists to form a clear opinion as to what happened, but the above pattern of facts is consistent with a massive $100 billion-plus financial crime as part of the 9/11 op. The 9/11 investigation cover-ups. In the aftermath of 9/11, Congress sponsored two government-run investigations into the 9/11 attacks. The first, the Joint Inquiry into Intelligence Community Activities Before and After the Terrorist Attacks of September the 11th, 2001, was run by Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss. Porter Goss was a long-time CIA agent. He was a member of Operation 40, a CIA task force active in anti-Castro activity around the time of the Bay of Pigs operation. Many members of Operation 40 played an active role in the coup of 63. Goss spent the entire early 1960s based at JM Wave, the CIA station in Miami, where he worked with Ted Shackley, David Sanchez Morales, Edward Lansdale, William Harvey, and Tracy Barnes, all of whom were active players in the coup of 63. Porter Goss was also involved in the Iran-Contra profiteering, where he earned $12 million on a series of fraudulent deals. Bob Graham was also a participant in some Iran-Contra-related fraudulent investments. Goss and Graham made it clear that their goal was not to identify specific wrongdoing. Graham said the inquiry would not play, quote, the blame game about what went wrong from an intelligence perspective, unquote. Goss said, quote, this is not a who shall we hang type of investigation. It's about where are the gaps in America's defense and what do we do about it type of investigation, unquote. However, despite the compromised nature of the investigators and the limited mission of the inquiry, and its being under-resourced, the joint inquiry did document a clear connection between the Saudi government and the 9/11 attacks. However, the 28 pages in the report that documented Saudi government and intelligence ties to the hijackers were classified by President Bush. Senator Graham has repeatedly spoken out about the Saudi government connection. In 2011, Graham wrote in the Daily Beast, quote, why would Saudi Arabia do this? Do the Saudis have the will and capability to aid future attacks against the United States? And most important, why the cover-up by our government? I have attempted to address these questions in the final report of the Congressional Commission and the non-fiction book Intelligence Matters, published in 2004. Each was censored by authorities in the intelligence community, particularly on the role of the Saudis in 9/11. Unquote. After protests from the families of the 9/11 victims about a lack of investigation into the attacks, President Bush reluctantly created the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission. Like the vast majority of congressional committees investigating high-level government crimes, the 9/11 Commission was designed to be a cover-up. Senator Max Cleland, one of the only vigilant members of the commission, stepped down in December 2003 and became an outspoken critic of the cover-up. Cleland later said, quote, this is a scam. It's disgusting. America is being cheated. As each day goes by, we learn that this government knew a whole lot more about these terrorists before September the 11th than it has ever admitted. Let's chase this rabbit into the ground. They had a plan to go to war, and when 9/11 happened, that's what they did. They went to war. Unquote. 9/11 Commission co-chair Lee Hamilton says, quote, I don't believe for a minute that we got everything right. Unquote. That the commission was set up to fail, that people should keep asking questions about 9/11, and that the 9/11 debate should continue. John Farmer, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, who led the 9/11 staff's inquiry, said, quote, at some level of government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened. Unquote. He also said, quote, I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public for 2 years. This is not spin. This is not true. It's almost a culture of concealment, for a lack of a better word. There were interviews made at the FAA's New York Center the night of 9/11, and those tapes were destroyed. The CIA tapes of the interrogations were destroyed. The story of 9/11 itself, to put it mildly, was distorted and was completely different from the way things happened. Unquote. Raymond McGovern, a 27-year CIA veteran who chaired National Intelligence Estimates and personally delivered intelligence briefings to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, their Vice President, Secretaries of State, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and many other government officials, said, quote, I think at simplest terms, there's a cover-up. The 9/11 report is a joke. Unquote. Melvin Goodman, Division Chief of the CIA's Office of Soviet Affairs, who served as senior analyst from 1966 to 1990 and professor of international security at the National War College from 1986 to 2004, said, quote, the final 9/11 Commission report is ultimately a cover-up. Unquote. The press cover-up. Integral to the 9/11 op has been the media cover. Leveraging many decades of work on controlling the press by the national security state, the Bush Syndicate continued the ongoing program of press control to effectively censor coverage of 9/11. The mechanics of the media cover-up involve a number of different components. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the country came together in a burst of patriotic fervor. The Bush administration skillfully manipulated this patriotic response to create an environment where questioning the government was considered unpatriotic. Air Force Colonel and key Pentagon official Karen Kwiatkowski, who blew the whistle on the Bush administration's to concoct false intelligence about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, wrote, quote, "I've been told by reporters that they will not report their own insights or contrary evaluations of the official 9/11 story, because to question the government story about 9/11 is to question the very foundations of our entire modern belief system regarding our government, our country, and our way of life. To be charged with questioning these foundations is far more serious than being labeled a disgruntled conspiracy nut or anti-government traitor, or even being sidelined or marginalized within an academic government service or literary career. To question the official 9/11 story is simply and fundamentally revolutionary. In this way, of course, questioning the official story is also simply and fundamentally American." Unquote.
Several months after 9/11, famed news anchor Dan Rather told the BBC that American reporters were practicing, quote, "a form of self-censorship," unquote. There was a time in South Africa that people would put flaming tires around people's necks if they dissented. And in some ways, the fear is that you'll be necklaced here. You'll have a flaming tire of lack of patriotism put around your neck. Now, it is that fear that keeps journalists from asking the toughest of the tough questions. And again, I am humble to say I do not exempt myself from this criticism. What we're talking about here, whether one wants to recognize it or not, or call it by its proper name or not, is a form of self-censorship. Unquote. The head of CNN agreed, quote, "There was almost a patriotism police after 9/11, and when the network showed things critical of the administration's policies, it would get calls from advertisers and the administration, and big people in corporations were calling up and saying, 'You're being anti-American here,'" unquote. Keith Olbermann said, quote, "You can rock the boat, but you can never say that the entire ocean is in trouble. You cannot say, 'By the way, there's something wrong with our system,'" unquote. Former Washington Post, now Huffington Post, columnist Dan Frumkin wrote in 2006, "Mainstream media political journalism is in danger of becoming increasingly irrelevant, but not because of the Internet or even Comedy Central. The threat comes from inside. It comes from journalists being afraid of what journalists were put on this green earth to do. There's the intense pressure to maintain access to insider sources, even as those sources become ridiculously unrevealing and oversensitive. There's the fear of being labelled partisan if one's bullshit calling isn't meted out in precisely equal increments along the political spectrum. If mainstream media political journalists don't start calling bullshit more often, then we do risk losing our primacy, if not to the comedians, then to the bloggers. I still believe that no one is fundamentally more capable of first-rate bullshit calling than a well-informed beat reporter, whatever their beat. We just need to get the editors, or the corporate culture, or the self-censorship, or whatever it is, out of the way." Unquote. Dan Ellsberg says the government has ordered the media not to cover 9/11. Ellsberg seemed hardly surprised that today's American mainstream broadcast media has so far failed to take former FBI translator and 9/11 whistleblower Sybil Edmonds up on her offer, despite the blockbuster nature of her allegations, which Ellsberg calls far more explosive than the Pentagon Papers. As Edmonds has also alluded, Ellsberg pointed to the New York Times, who sat on the NSA spying story for over a year, when they could have put it out before the 2004 election, which might have changed the outcome. He told us, quote, "There will be phone calls going out to the media saying, 'Don't even think of touching it.
you'll be prosecuted for violating national security. Unquote.
Post-9/11 death squads. In addition to the congressional cover-ups, the media censorship, and the active disinformation campaign, the cabal behind the 9/11 attacks has been systematically killing key witnesses, journalists, and anybody capable of getting a government inquiry into the 9/11 attacks started. These deaths include witnesses who saw various aspects of the 9/11 op, like Catherine Smith, a Tennessee DMV employee who sold IDs to five of the hijackers. In February 2002, a day before Catherine was supposed to testify in court about her actions, she was firebombed in her car and killed. Dr. David Graham, the Shreveport, Louisiana dentist who saw three of the 9/11 hijackers with a Pakistani business, was poisoned in September 2006. Barry Jennings, who was witness to early explosions within World Trade Center 7, was killed in August 2008. Kenneth Yohannemann, who was a witness to explosions in the basement of World Trade Center 1 prior to the plane strikes, was killed by a gunshot wound to the head in September 2008. Bertha Champagne, the longtime babysitter for Marvin Bush, was crushed by a car in Marvin Bush's driveway. Journalists who got too close to the truth also suffered a terrible fate. Hunter S. Thompson was working on a major story about the World Trade Center towers being brought down by explosives when he was murdered on February 19, 2005. Philip Marshall was a retired airline pilot with over 20,000 hours of experience flying Boeing jets. He wrote two clear, concise books outlining the 9/11 op. He was shot along with his two children on February 1, 2013. The Bush Syndicate has recognized governmental legal proceedings as a threat and has been working to systematically kill anyone who could have gotten a court case or government investigation going. Beverly Eckert was a 9/11 widow who chose to sue for justice rather than accept the $1.8 million payment for the death of her husband. She wrote in a moving editorial that is worth reading, quote, "I say to Congress, big business, and everyone who conspired to divert attention from government and private sector failures, my husband's life was priceless, and I will not let his death be meaningless. My silence cannot be bought." Unquote. Beverly Eckert was killed in a plane crash. Most likely, this crash was one in a long line of plane crashes used to kill high-profile threats to the criminal syndicate at the heart of the national security state. Michael Doran was a lawyer working with families on 9/11 victims on a variety of lawsuits, and he also flew small airplanes. On April 29, 2009, Michael was killed when his plane crashed. Prior to the crash, Michael had reported multiple incidents of his plane being sabotaged. The criminal forces within the national security state have a long history of killing many people for the purposes of hiding the death of one key, high-profile individual. Major General David Worley and his wife Anne were claimed to be among the victims of the Washington, D.C. metro crash in June 2009. Seven other people were killed in this crash. General Worley would have been a key witness to the high-level orders issued on 9/11 regarding the air defenses over D.C. The above list of people is just an abbreviated list. In many cases, it's hard to know if a person was murdered. But in any case, active, professional, highly organized death squads are out killing innocent Americans who pose a threat to the criminal syndicate buried within the federal government. Now, there's empty sections about 9/11 as part of a comprehensive coup, 15 years in the making, the New World Order, an almost empty section on the George W. Bush administration. Obama. The popular myth about Barack Obama is that he was a charismatic community organizer who rose to political prominence based upon his natural abilities. However, a deeper look shows Obama to have been groomed from the time he was in college by members of the power elite, My reading of the situation is that he was recruited as a CIA asset while a student at Occidental. His family had been in the orbit of CIA operations since before Barak was born. Obama transferred from Occidental to Columbia University during his junior year in college. His time at Columbia is cloaked in mystery. Wayne Allen Root was, like Obama, a political science major at Columbia, who also graduated in 1983. In 2008, Root said of Obama, quote, "I don't know a single person at Columbia that knew him, and they all know me. I don't have a classmate who ever knew Barack Obama at Columbia. Ever. Nobody recalls him. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not kidding." Unquote. According to Professor Henry Graf, quote, "I don't consider him a Columbia student. I have no idea what he did on the Columbia campus. No one knows him." Unquote. In an age where the college records of presidential candidates are generally released to the public, Barack Obama stands alone in keeping his college records sealed. In June of 1981, right after moving to New York City, with almost no money, Obama was able to travel to Indonesia and Pakistan, despite Pakistan being on the State Department's no-travel list in 1981. In Pakistan, Obama went on a partridge hunting trip with Mohammed Sumro, who would go on to become acting president of Pakistan in 2008. At Columbia, Obama wrote his thesis on arms reduction negotiations between the U.S. and the USSR. U.S.-Soviet relations were the speciality of Columbia faculty member, Trilateral Commission founder, and Obama policy advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Immediately after college, Obama took a job in New York with Business International Corporation, which served as a CIA front in various operations around the globe. After 2 years there, Obama moved to Chicago and began work as a community organizer. While working as a community organizer, Obama applied to Harvard Law School. However, Obama was not just another law school applicant. He had help from a network of wealthy, powerful people. Khalid al-Mansour was the principal advisor to one of the world's richest men, Saudi Prince al-Wahid bin Talal. In 1987, al-Mansour approached prominent black leader and former Manhattan Borough president, Percy Sutton, and asked him to write a recommendation to his friends at Harvard Law School on Obama's behalf. At Harvard Law School, Obama was selected to the prestigious role of president of the Law Review. After law school, Obama moved back to Chicago, where he took a job as a lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. According to Doug Ross, Obama applied for a teaching position at the University of Chicago Law School and was rejected. But a few weeks later, the Board of Trustees called the law school and told them to put Obama on the faculty. Obama then used the University of Chicago position as a platform for a future career. Despite not having accomplished anything in his life more significant than attending prestigious schools, Obama used the faculty position to write his memoir, Dreams of My Father. The University of Chicago boasts the highest output of published papers per professor of any law school in the country. However, in 12 years on the faculty, Obama did not publish a single journal article. While in Chicago, Obama cultivated powerful friends, such as Penny Pritzker, and a network of Chicago's elite. While running for U.S. Senate in 2004, Obama benefited from aggressive reporting from the Chicago Tribune that targeted first his primary opponent Blair Hull, and then Republican nominee Jack Ryan, who was destroyed when, in a highly unusual move, a Los Angeles judge granted a request by the Chicago Tribune to unseal Ryan's divorce records, despite both Ryan and his ex-wife Jerry Ryan's wishes that the records be kept sealed. The records contained a claim by Jack that suggested Jerry have sex with him in public at a swingers club. This revelation undermined Ryan's campaign, and he withdrew from the race. While he was still just a candidate for Senate, Obama was selected to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention in 2004. Obama's speech rocketed him to national prominence. By the time the 2008 presidential election rolled around, Obama had become the favorite Democratic candidate of the power elite. With the remarkable uniformity that is evidence of a massive intelligence propaganda campaign, the controlled corporate media backed Obama heavily and pummeled Senator Clinton. Obama went on to victory in November, with talk of hope and change. Obama's administration has proven to be a great disappointment for most Obama supporters. Instead of delivering change, Obama has continued most of the worst of the policies of the Bush administration. The Patriot Act has been renewed. Government secrecy has been taken to new levels. Obama has conducted a war on whistleblowers who seek to improve the government. The US military is active in more countries, and so on and so on. Obama can be seen as a right-wing spy within the cover of a liberal Democrat. This characterization correctly fits all available information about Obama's background, and it also fits with the policy positions that Obama has taken. Using this analysis, back in March 2008, Webster Tarpley was able to correctly predict Obama's behavior in office by analyzing the policies of Obama advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski. Tarpley was able to predict that Obama would pivot from trying to start a war with Iran to the more dangerous approach of militarily provoking Russia. And that's where the essay finishes. As such, there's a lot more notes, from which I shall pull out the last word and give it to Jimmy Carter. Gorton notes that on July 17, 2013, Jimmy Carter said, quote, "America does not, at the moment, have a functioning democracy," unquote.